This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Newman, a host of this channel, and today I'm speaking with Elizabeth Schwall, author of the book Dancing with the Revolution, Power, Politics, and Privilege in Cuba. This book was published by UNC Press in 2021, and Elizabeth is an assistant professor of history at Northern Arizona University. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel. I'm so excited to be here.
So am I. So could you begin by telling us how you came to this project?
Yeah, of course. So it started as an undergraduate. I danced all my life, and I wanted to combine my passion for dance and growing passion for Latin American history. I was participating in some kind of historically geared reconstruction projects related to staging dances from the early 20th century and the 1970s, and was thinking a lot about dance and history. At the same time, I was taking a seminar co-taught by a literary scholar, Arcadio Diaz-Quiñones, and a historian, Jeremy Edelman. And it was about intellectuals in Latin America, and we read Fidel Castro's words, The Intellectual Speech. And I was really struck because in that speech, he mentions both the ballet and modern dance companies in Cuba. And as a dancer, it really stood out to me. I was shocked. I couldn't imagine a U.S. leader mentioning artists or dancers in a major address. So I was just really intrigued and found that by researching more, that Cuba was a really good case study for thinking about the relationship between artists and politics more broadly, and dancers in particular. And so as an undergraduate, I wrote a junior paper and then a senior thesis about 1960s and first ballet and then ballet and modern dance. And then when I went to graduate school, I expanded the project out to also include folkloric dance. And I greatly extended the timeframes from 19 into what it became for my book, which is 1930 roughly to 1990. So it was just a process of kind of expanding out and honing my questions, obviously, getting some real archival research. And that's kind of how I came to what became my book.
So one of the contributions that you make in this book is to help us to rethink the chronology of 20th century Cuban history. And I'm sure we'll hear more about this in your answers to some of the questions later on. But I thought maybe you could start by giving listeners who might not be as familiar with Cuban history some guideposts to what are the sort of standard periods that we use to think about sort of the last century of Cuban history.
Yeah, of course. So I think when we think about 20th century Cuban history, we kind of start actually in the late 19th century. So the Wars for Independence, which were on and off for about 30 years from 1868 to 1898. 1898, Cubans were kind of in the final thrust of gaining independence from Spain when the United States intervened. And there was, this was kind of a long time coming. We could have a whole other discussion about all the signs, the economic and political signs that the United States was interested in Cuba going back for decades. But in any case, the United States intervened. Cuban independence was a little bit frustrated. It was ultimately achieved in name, but was frustrated. And then we enter a period from 1898 to basically 1959, in which you have a lot of U.S. intervention and involvement in Cuban economics, politics, and society. And then kind of there's a huge dividing line that came in with the Cuban Revolution of 1959, which kind of began as an outgrowth of previous decades of political struggles. You know, young people in their 30s in the 1950s thought about their parents and their grandparents and their political struggles, both for sovereignty and for social and economic programs and gains. And that rallying cry ultimately led to various groups throwing out a previous dictator who was in power in the 1950s and the quote-unquote triumph of the revolution in January of 1959. And then we have the revolutionary period. So from 1898 to 1959, you kind of have this period of the republic. And then you have the revolutionary period. And again, these are kind of just very general categories, but it's kind of like a before and after story in the 20th century Cuban history. And then 1990, I think, is another important milestone, which came with the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of a lot of economic and political support for, by then, the socialist Communist Republic of Cuba. So those are just some rough guideposts, I would say, of the 20th century.
Great. So let's start in the pre-revolutionary era. And in your book, you explained that before 1959, ballet already had an important place in the Cuban cultural landscape, even though it didn't have a great deal of support from governments in power. So how was it that dance makers in this era built power for themselves and their art form?
Yeah, so I found that, you know, when I started working on this project, there was just this question of why ballet in 1959, which is ballet has kind of a I would say, an elitist history in that it came out of, you know, bourgeois European courts and was very tied to courtly life. And so it kind of maintained this association with whiteness of Europe or Russia or where have you, and also this kind of elite taste. And so to understand why ballet became an important kind of revolutionary art form after 1959, you had to understand why it was because it had this prehistory. And as you noted, before 1959, ballet was very important to Cubans and Cuba. It was kind of a pride, a point of pride. And this derived kind of, I would say, because of both a deep interest in the arts and culture, which was developed kind of structurally by these civic associations starting in kind of the 19 teens and 20s and 30s. But it was also due to the fact that there happened to be some really talented Cuban dancers that rose to fame internationally. So most notably, there was a ballerina named Alicia Alonso, who really had a meteoric rise to stardom in the United States in the 1940s. There was also her husband, Fernando Alonso, who also had a career internationally, but he became known as more of the teacher. And he was a revered teacher, not just in Cuba, but was recognized in other countries as well. And then there was Alberto Alonso, Fernando's brother, Alicia's brother-in-law, who became a renowned choreographer, also developing a career internationally, dancing in Europe and in the United States before returning to Cuba. So these three figures are really important. I also try to talk about the fact that there were many other very important artists outside of these kind of this triad, which has been, you know, talked about quite a great deal in historiography about dance in Cuba and ballet specifically. But nevertheless, we have to begin with them in the sense that they became notable figures. Alicia, by the late 40s, was already kind of recognized as a national hero. So the fact that these figures made ballet into something that was tied with patriotism, nationalism, and had allowed Cuba to kind of enter the international stage through this art form helped to build their personal capital, cultural and political capital, and also made it, it makes more sense why ballet continued to be such an important art form for Cuba and Cubans culturally and politically after 1959.
So can you talk a little bit more about the sort of racial associations and maybe racist or anti-racist practices associated with ballet in this pre-revolutionary era?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, at least in Cuban imaginaries, ballet was very much racialized as white. And this derived from the fact that when ballet classes first started on the island in the early 30s, it was through the venue primarily of more elite civic associations, cultural associations, primarily a society called Pro Arte Musical, which was, supported opera and concert music, but also started ballet classes. And then eventually also very much supported dance, concert dance or theatrical dance, dance that appeared on a stage for an audience rather than, say, dance in ritual or revelry in everyday life. And so even though ballet started, had these roots in whiteness and also kind of the premier practitioners that got international careers and fame like Alicia Alonso were white in Cuban imaginaries. Nevertheless, I found that especially starting in the 50s, there were people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds that also started their dance studies. For instance, there was Jorge Lefebvre, who I talk about in chapter one, who he was from Santiago, the eastern part of the island, also kind of racialized as African descended in Cuban imaginaries. And he had such talent that he did receive scholarships to help support his career, but there were limits to what he could achieve in Cuba. And he ended up needing to go abroad, and he ended up dancing with a very important African-American choreographer and dancer, Catherine Dunham, who was based in New York, and he joined her company and toured with them in Europe. And then in Europe is where he kind of made his career, and he ended up kind of living the rest of his life and career in Europe. So that's just one really notable example of the fact that on the one hand, even though we think about how Cuban ballet was extremely narrow in terms of inclusivity, there were people that were training in ballet that were not white in Cuba, who were of African descent or mixed racial and ethnic backgrounds. So that's an important thing to recognize. And it's also important to recognize, however, that there were definite limits to their career, like what Lefebvre encountered. So that gives a sense of the fact that, before the revolution, there was limits to the kind of bodies that could appear and were received by not just companies, but also audiences. So there was kind of this policing aspect on who and what kind of content was allowed on more elite concert dance or theatrical dance stages.
So the rest of the chapters in your book are set after the revolution. And the first one of these is about institutionalization. So I think that's a word that could make us think that the story is going to kind of somehow get less exciting. And I think that it's actually quite the opposite. So what exactly is this process of institutionalization in the case of dance in Cuba? And what do you find especially fascinating about it?
Yeah, so absolutely. I can totally understand why that word is not provocative. It does sound very dry. I think one of the reasons why I was still, nevertheless, very excited by it was, one of the goals of the book is to hopefully speak to historians that have absolutely no interest in dance or performance or cultural production. And, you know, how institutions are formed was profoundly important to the revolutionary leaders. So the quote that kind of opens the epigraph of the chapter is by Che Guevara, the revolutionary icon. And it's about this process of institutionalization. And, you know, historians have debated, perhaps not the most exciting debates, and political scientists have debated, perhaps not the most exciting debates, about this process of institutionalization. And I found that there was kind of this assumption that the 60s was kind of all over the place. I'm sure there were mass organizations that were formed. There were indeed important institutions established, but it was really in the 70s that, you know, everyone recognized that, you know, institutions really solidified for various reasons. And I found that dance and dancers really pushed for their institutions to solidify by the early 60s. And I found that these institutional developments continue to this day to shape what we see in the dance scene. Of course, it's changed and shifted for many complex reasons, but I was just struck by how much lasting power these institutions had. And so a big part of the story of institutionalization is about figuring out how to navigate these political shifts, how artists are able to continue pre-revolutionary artistic goals, but also take advantage of political openings, cultural openings, and also trying to grapple with this, longer history, because dance didn't just emerge fully formed out of kind of the brain of Fidel Castro, but instead as the chapters on the pre-revolutionary history detail. There were choreographers and dancers active in the decades before the revolution, who would then be very active after the revolution. So two choreographers that I talk about a great deal in the second chapter, Ramiro Guerra and Alberto Alonso, are already experimenting with how to deal or how to stage race and nation in choreography. And they're trying to experiment with this in the 40s and 50s. And then they'll continue to experiment with this in the 60s and onward. So as institutionalization is happening, there's a lot of growing pains, and there's kind of an effort to draw lines between different genres. So the genres I look at and focus on, especially, and that really begin to consolidate after 1959, are ballet, which the main national company that I focus on, which is based in Havana, is the Ballet Nacional de Cuba. And then there's modern dance, which for people who are not familiar with dance, modern dance in Cuba really comes out of, they draw the innovators of Cuban modern dance techniques draw direct lineages to actually U.S. modern dance innovators, because a really important figure in the development of Cuban modern dance, Ramiro Guerra, he spends time in New York in the 1940s, in the late 40s, and he kind of brings back those techniques and tries to Cubanize them by particularly drawing upon Afro-Cuban culture. So you have a modern dance form that's developing in Cuba, and company, a main national company, which has various names in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but today is known as Danza Contemporánea de Cuba. And that is based out of the National Theater. And then you have a folkloric company, which forms third. And so the ballet was kind of reconstituted itself in 1959. Modern dance also in 1959. The Folkloric Dance Company is founded in 1962. And that's the Conjunto Folklorico Nacional. And so as the story of institutionalization plays out in the chapter, I talk about how we see not all companies were created equal, and they didn't have equal support. So you have ballet having the most support very from the beginning. So there's kind of this mythic story of Fidel Castro who visits Fernando Alonso late one night, brought by revolutionary Antonio Nunez Jimenez. So in any case, he comes and says, kind of, what do you need for the ballet? Fidel or Fernando quotes a number and Fidel says, I'll double it. And this, of course, kind of erases the fact that Fernando and Alicia Alonso had been pushing for this number for years. In any case, so the ballet gets a legally sanctioned subsidy, whereas both modern and folkloric dance are kind of struggling to kind of prove themselves to cultural bureaucrats and audiences, that there's value in these forms and that they're revolutionary. And as they try to do this, modern dance has some success, probably largely tied to the fact that Ramiro Guerra, who was instrumental in developing the form and the company, had good political ties. He was part of Nuestro Tiempo, which was a kind of leftist cultural society that got on the kind of revolutionary bandwagon in the late 50s. He also had this kind of anti-racist rhetoric and discourse that he tied to, that was very resonant with the revolution, that, you know, resonated with political development. And another really important aspect of why modern dance was successful in getting support pretty early on was the fact that there was a woman named Lorna Birdsall, who she was a U.S. expat who was married to a really important revolutionary notable, Manuel Pinedo, who would go on to become, instrumental in the Ministry of the Interior. So with all of these kind of privileges and connections to power, modern dance is also able to secure, you know, subsidies, performance space, theaters, etc. And then you have the Folkloric Dance Company, which struggled a bit more. And this was largely due to racism and class prejudice, because the majority of the performers in the Conjunto Folklorico Nacional from the beginning were of African descent. They were also, shoemakers, laundresses. They were kind of working class folks. And the evidence of these racial and class prejudices just pop out of memos and letters and just documents from the Ministry of Culture, which make it so clear that there's a great deal of discomfort with funding a company that supposedly promotes only Black dance. And those are the words that were used in the documents at the time. So I found that institutionalization was a very racially and culturally fraught or class fraught process, in which there's all of these prejudices that are coming up in the process. And so ultimately, by just looking at salaries, at subsidies and symbolic gestures, it's very clear that ballet, which retained its kind of elite and white connotations, gets the most support from the government.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So you then move on to a chapter that's about gender and sexuality in the world of dance in Cuba. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how radical maybe the revolution was in reshaping norms about masculinity and femininity, both in the sort of dance context and more generally, and if those gender norms were sort of the same for dancers or different than they were for other Cuban citizens.
Yeah, that's a great way of framing it, because I think that there, of course, the revolution, you know, throughout history, you can kind of see examples of when regime changes happen. New regimes will hold on to kind of like older ideas, particularly about gender, to kind of help legitimate the new order. And so things certainly changed, but not in terms of in a progressive direction. So there was homophobia and heteronormative, you know, ideals before the revolution. And these were definitely glommed onto and strengthened and continued in the revolutionary period with new, maybe even insidious connotations. Other scholars like Lillian Gebba have written wonderful analyses of how we see a revolutionary patriarchy developing revolutionary versions of homophobia. And so that definitely frames what we see dancers trying to do in terms of navigating homophobia, a revolutionary homophobia that very much exists, and revolutionary ideas about masculinity and femininity, which are frankly very traditional and conservative and narrow. And so the epigraph that opened this chapter quotes Fidel, talking about how homosexual people can never be full revolutionaries, and Che Guevara talking about how artists have this original sin. And I think that there was always a suspicion about artists and cultural producers, partially due to suspicions about their sexual orientation. And dancers were no exception, and maybe even dealt with this more than, say, writers or filmmakers, because dance in Cuba and basically everywhere else in the world at this time, and even through present times, tends to be glossed as a feminine art form. And this is, of course, something that I don't want to say that it was, you know, unchanging and or stagnant or what have you. There have been changes over time. Of course, dance was not always considered a feminine art, but at least in the 20th century, this has been the tendency. And as a product of this, there was a lot of nervousness and suspicion, especially of male ballet dancers, because, you know, ballet was so associated with the ballerina in the 20th century, and especially in Cuba with Alicia Alonso. Nevertheless, male ballet dancers had the benefits of Alicia Alonso's kind of political and cultural capital, which allowed her and Fernando Alonso, who kind of were the leaders of the Ballet Nacional, to kind of protect their own. And you do see suspicion of male dancers, particularly in other dance forms, in modern and folkloric dance, not necessarily as inherently, it wasn't necessarily a knee-jerk reaction, but there were quite a few state documents that I found that talked about leaders in these forms and a lot of policing of these figures, both at home and when they're on tour abroad, and a lot of detailing of their personal lives and partners and suspected partners. Nevertheless, as I kind of talk about in the chapter, I found that dancers were able to continue working, whether that was at home and in many cases abroad, despite the fact that there were a lot of humiliating defections, humiliating for Cuba and the government, but not necessarily, of course, for and perhaps the company leaders, but not necessarily for everybody. But nevertheless, even though there were these kind of high profile defections of dancers who had the privilege to perform in places like Paris or Mexico, and occasionally outside of the Soviet bloc, but as time went on, increasingly less so. But nevertheless, the fact that these dancers got to travel is a big part of their privilege in Cuban society. But nevertheless, unlike perhaps some well-known cases of, say, filmmakers or writers who didn't have those kind of privileges and ability to, you know, continue to create despite this homophobia, dancers, I found, were able to. And so I try to explain in the chapter why I think that is. I think it had something to do with the fact that leaders of these companies were really adept at utilizing their power and their privilege to protect their own. I think it was the fact that internationally, dancers were, you know, widely acclaimed, and government officials, cultural bureaucrats, kind of saw the benefits outweighing the risks. And I also think there was something to the degree, it was a case-by-case basis, but a lot of the dancers who were sanctioned or suspected managed to, you know, play the game, as, you know, was famously, the phrase famously goes, and were able to either marry, to, you know, make it appear as though they were heteronormative, or were able to be discreet in their liaisons. But nevertheless, I was surprised by the fact that dancers were able to continue working, despite the fact that just by being dancers, by being artists, by potentially having same-sex relationships, they were kind of outside of the revolutionary norms of masculinity and femininity.
So a really powerful aspect of the story that you're telling in this book is that the dance makers you examine have just a really broad audience, in the sense that the scope of it, of this dancing public, actually extends to the masses in Cuba, and then also goes abroad, as you've just spoken about in your last answer. So how exactly did dance makers cultivate this audience, both at home and in other countries? And what was political about the engagements that they had with other Cuban citizens and citizens of other countries?
Yeah, so I do love to see how, you know, I talk about in the chapter how I'm a little obsessed with the audience, both at home and abroad. And it's such an elusive aspect of the whole story. I think any historian who tries to talk about, you know, book culture or even any other aspect where you're trying, you know, food consumption, you're so curious about the consumer. And those are often the voices that are so hard to capture or to understand outside of, say, oral history or what have you. Nevertheless, I was obsessed with the audience, but so were the dancers, and so was the government, essentially. So in chapter five, I talk about kind of the projects that dancers engaged in partnership with the government to build an audience at home. And this was of premier importance for ideological and just logistical reasons. So ideologically, starting right after 1959, there is this hope that there's this discourse of democratization, of you know, enlightenment, education. There's the 1961 literacy campaign. And right alongside all of this are efforts to basically bring the arts and arts instruction to farms, to, you know, rural areas of Cuba to try to deal with this historic divide, class and educational divide, which of course has geographic, class, and racial components to it. So in any case, this is a very important aspect of revolutionary ideology and politics. And dancers see it not only ideologically, you know, sure, that checks that box, but also no performer likes to perform to an empty audience. And, you know, Cubans of all types, you know, dancers or otherwise, will talk about proudly the warm and you know, passionate audiences that there are for the arts. And this was just not an accident, you know. So some aspects of these campaigns involved things like lecture demonstrations. So there were instances when all of the companies that I look at in that are Havana based, and also I start looking at the Ballet de Camagüey, which was based in Camagüey. They all did kind of these lecture demonstrations where they would tour the country once a year, sometimes multiple times a year, and they would appear in stadiums. They would appear in factories, ice cream factories, you know, other types of factories. They would appear at schools, at universities. And so these performances were meant to cultivate, you know, ballet or modern dance or folkloric dance lovers and audiences. And this really ratchets up in the 70s because for various reasons, one of which is kind of politically based, there's shifts in the cultural bureaucracy. There's a kind of emphasis on more didactic art. There's greater Soviet influences. There's various reasons, but in the 70s, there's even more of an emphasis on kind of this mass-based artist figure that they're trying to create and promote. So I found that ballet and ballet leaders really struggled in that they were not really able to cultivate amateur or non-professional ballet dancers as well as, say, modern or folkloric dance. So they weren't really able to fit in with this kind of trend of the 70s. Nevertheless, they continued, you know, working hard to cultivate an audience of people that was supposed to love ballet. They did this through increased media exposure, so radio programs, television programs, which are still around today, and a magazine, so those kind of things, and these kind of free performances. But they also did it through things like they said, you know, we're workers just like you. We're going to come and we're going to perform for you. And then we're going to harvest sugarcane with you. Or, you know, as time went on, that was deemed like too difficult for ballet bodies or just too taxing on their instruments. And so they tended to do things like pick coffee beans or something that was a little less taxing. Nevertheless, these were all efforts to cultivate a sense of solidarity with the audience and try to almost paper over the fact that at the end of the day, a lot of these professional dancers had this power and privilege that their audience members didn't have. They were cosmopolitan. They traveled annually outside of the country. So I think it's really interesting to see these tensions. And it really shows some of the ironic limitations of this discourse of democracy, just as they're trying to make concert dance writ large, whether it's folkloric, modern, or ballet, into kind of a mass pastime. At the same time, you're constantly reifying and finding evidence of these distinctions between the artist enlightener and the enlightened in the audience. And so I really find that there's a lot of ambiguity and ambivalence in that project. In terms of international audiences, I talk about this idea of dance internationalism, which really resonates with, I think, a better known version of internationalism. This idea of revolution everywhere will help support revolution at home, which was just an integral part of the revolutionary project in Cuba. And the more famous version, I think, is medical internationalism. So even in 2020, you know, Cuban doctors went to Italy at the worst moments of the pandemic. So that was just one example of this idea of, you know, medical experts supporting people around the world. And I found dancers did the same. So they not only performed for short-term gigs, if you will, to kind of impress international audiences, but they also choreographed, they taught all over. So this was throughout Europe, in different parts of Africa, throughout the Americas, and a little bit in Asia as well. And I think that that was a really important, it had different political resonances that I talk about. So one is in terms of ballet dancers, they tended to perform a great deal in the Soviet Union. There were important instances of them performing in Paris and in Europe, as well as the United States and Canada. And the idea with that was that, you know, I found there was a lot of Cuban press observed and Cuban dancers themselves promoted this idea that, see, we're not so different from you. We have a ballet tradition that rivals you, Paris or New York or Moscow. So there was this very kind of elitist almost, there's a consensus around the world that, you know, we love ballet and that is what we uphold. And so I found this kind of ironic, you know, consensus between the so-called first, second, and third world being Cuba in this case, in this valuing of ballet and this effort to connect despite political and ideological divides. I also talk about how there was this effort to kind of be a leader in Latin America, for instance. So this I see playing out, especially in ballet and modern dance, in which just as guerrilla fighters are no longer leaving Cuba to go support leftist armed movements throughout Latin America, you see ballet and modern dancers flooding the Americas to be supporting companies, choreographing, teaching, etc., and spending sometimes a year at a time or going back several times to kind of help fellow Latin American nations and be this kind of regional leader. And then finally, a really important aspect of this dance internationalism that I noticed was the ways in which especially the folkloric company and modern dancers and particularly dancers of African descent who either imagined or connections between Cuba and Africa in staged productions, or there were cases in which some Cubans, particularly modern dancers, spent time in Angola and other places and taught dance classes, et cetera. So I find that these international projects were really important, but for different reasons. And putting all these different reasons together is precisely what I tried to do with the book, in that I wanted to kind of compare how different dance forms resonated and operated in the world, and how these different dance forms really staged Cuba and the revolution in the world. And I think another really important aspect of this international component is not only these political resonances, but this a very key economic component, in that when Cubans performed or worked for months and even a year in foreign countries, they received hard currency honorariums, which was far more than what they received at home. And so that went into kind of developing different hierarchical forms of privilege. And so ballet dancers went abroad and worked abroad the most, followed by modern dancers. And then folkloric dancers tended to get less international contracts in the period that I'm looking at, in terms of post-revolution 1959 to 1990. So that also goes into these kind of differential privileges that I see, and kind of these hierarchies that we see in terms of the dance field.
So as you explained a little bit earlier, 1990 is sort of a benchmark year for the start of a new era in Cuban politics. But what you explain in your last chapter is that there were changes in the dance world that sort of preceded that time frame. So what were some of the frustrations that were being expressed by dancers in the 70s and 80s? And what were some of the innovations that they spearheaded? And I also wanted to ask why it matters that these developments preceded the fall of the Soviet Union and then the economic challenges that that would unleash in Cuba.
Yeah, so a lot of the frustrations were tied to things like that will sound very familiar to people who maybe study, you know, other realms of Cuban life. So the fact that the revolution by the 80s, you know, was a people born and reaching maturity in the 80s were born after the revolution. So they felt a little more distant from this kind of political fervor that for people who were in the thick of revolutionary struggles of the 50s and feeling that sense of collective triumph or what have you, that was a little more distant. That was something that maybe they identified with their parents. And other historians have talked about this and analyzed this, and I draw in their work, like Michael Bustamante, for instance. In any case, so those just like baseline generational changes was part of it. Another important aspect was the fact that institutions that I talked about and their formation in that chapter three, they also began to show their age. And they were just large. So you have those three main companies in Havana having dancers that were maybe in their 40s or 50s who had yet to see the stage, even 60s or 70s. In some cases, Alicia Alonso, for instance, ended up dancing into her 70s or appearing on stage. So you have these older generation dancers who have not yet seated the stage at that point. Then you have all the generations of amazing dancers who were trained after the revolution, who are kind of part of the companies, but either waiting in the wings or feeling as though they're not being featured as much. So those kind of frustrations and just this feeling of, you know, a hunger to not only have, say, center stage or be able to express their choreographic voice, but also to say something that resonates with their own generation. So, you know, there was, I spoke with amazing choreographers who came of age in this 1980s moment, who talked about how, first of all, they were very inspired and in dialogue with visual artists and musicians of the period, but also felt like they were always taught to kind of, in socialist Cuba, we don't have angst. We don't have kind of these psychological needs or any discontent. You know, we're always happy. And they were like, I was not happy waiting in the sun for food for hours. I was not happy to be thirsty or not have access to, you know, basic creature comforts. And so they wanted to kind of convey their dissatisfaction. And so that's a big shift that we see in the 80s, at least in a lot of in terms of a lot of choreographers. And another thing that we see happening is a lot of these choreographers, so kind of going to your question of innovations, is we do see choreographers deciding to break out on their own. And this only starts to happen in the 80s. So the first non, you know, big national modern dance company was founded in 1981 by Lorna Birdsall, who was, she was older by that point. She wasn't part of this younger generation, but perhaps that allowed her to be the first kind of the founder of a non-main company, because she had these connections to power, albeit a little less because by that point she had divorced her husband, but she still had a lot of kind of cultural and political clout, was well respected. And in short order, you have a lot of other small companies being developed in the late 80s, particularly, and this will only continue and continue to explode in the 90s and onwards. So that institutional memory that I said that I was struck by its lasting power, there still is, you know, the Ballet Nacional, the Danza Contemporánea, Conjunto Folklórico Nacional, but then there's like all these little tiny companies that are just like also operating, which I think is you know, a product of the fact that there was just more talent than there was space for in these larger companies. So those are some developments in the 90s or in the 80s and why it matters that it happened then, or recognizing kind of their vanguard role in this is, I think that so often there's amazing literature on the so-called special period. So the post-1990 political and economic crisis that Cuba entered after the fall of the Soviet Union was euphemistically called by Fidel himself a special period. So there's so much amazing work on this special period. And I just felt that because so much was changing, scholars who are analyzing this period were like, wow, just everything was cracking open and there were just so many massive changes, which indeed I agree. I stopped my study before then, but I felt like there were these fractures and seeds and kind of foreshadowing of what was going to happen in the 90s by looking at the late 70s and 80s that I felt like hadn't been recognized before. And on top of that, I felt like way too much credit had been given to external forces. So, oh yes, the Soviet Union fell and therefore things, you know, exploded or fell apart or what have you in Cuba. And I felt as though, no, there were young dancers and choreographers that were yelling in their own way or, you know, gesturing in their choreography for these kind of openings. So it wasn't just something that we could attribute to external forces.
So taking our conversation to something a little closer to our own times, I wondered if you could draw any connections between your book and things that are happening in the present. We've seen lots of massive protests in Cuba in recent days. So I don't know if you got something to say about that.
Yeah, I wish I had more to say. I am just watching and reading and trying to understand a very rapidly changing situation. I think I'm also clouded by worry for my friends on the island and just trying to see how this will all play out, kind of holding my breath. And also, I could have spent another several days trying to wrap my head around just what's going on. But the one thing that really kind of sent chills down my spine was when I heard about the song Patria y Vida, which is a song which you can listen on YouTube. And it's kind of playing off the phrase, you know, patria or death, homeland or death, and now it's homeland and life. And I think it speaks to, and so there have been some discussion of how this has functioned as a rallying cry and really an inspirational one at that. A lot of, you know, brilliant scholars on my Twitter feed have been talking about this. And I think that it really speaks to me as someone who has spent the last 10 years thinking about how dancers were engaged politically, because I think, you know, in this moment, in this perhaps watershed, maybe in 50 years, when someone is being interviewed about their book, they will say 2021 was another, you know, big year, just like 1990 or 1959 or 1898. But in any case, I think that in these watershed moments and in all the more mundane moments in between, I think Cuban artists and cultural producers have played an outsized role in, you know, speaking to the ethos of the moment and in conveying important things, sentiments, emotions, frustrations, aspirations. And so, of course, my book doesn't speak about musicians at all. Not that I don't think musicians are phenomenally important, as this moment illustrates. But I think that dancers were also saying really important things, or perhaps not saying, but gesturing and indicating with their body. And those, that my conviction that that is true was why I wrote the book. So I wanted to give space and attention to those stories of those political gestures and movements that played a profound role, I think, in shaping and being a part of this revolutionary discourse and campaign that emerged and shifted over time. So that's not really saying much or shedding any real light on what's going on in the present, but only to point back to say that to me, when I heard that that reality, the significant that song, its significance, how it spoke to people, I was not surprised at all. I was like, yep, that completely jives with what I've seen over the past, you know, six decades or and before. So the significance of Cuban cultural producers in this larger political world.
We've been speaking today with Elizabeth Schwall about her new book, Dancing with the Revolution, Power, Politics, and Privilege in Cuba. Elizabeth, thanks so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.